If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
Don't let these people beat you. He said, all they want to do is take everything from you. And they can take your apartments, they can take your cars, they can take your houses and destroy your family, but they can't take your brains and they can't take your initiative.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Michael Mike Morawski is a 30-year real estate investment veteran. He has controlled over $285 million in real estate transactions. He's an entrepreneur, author, real estate trainer, public speaker, and personal coach with a strong personal resilience and deep desire to help others live an extraordinary life. He has coached hundreds of real estate investors to fulfill their dreams. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sam. Thanks for having me. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. The pleasure is all mine. The same questions I ask everybody who comes on is, where'd you start and where are you now?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is I didn't grow up in a family that was entrepreneurial. I didn't grow up in a family that had a real estate background. I kind of figured this out myself. You know, a couple things along the way when I was young, like I remember being on a vacation, family vacation. I was probably 8 years old and we're at a resort. And I'm asking my dad about all the rooms at this hotel, at this resort. In his own infinite little way, explained to me how people came there and paid the owner money. And that was the point I said, man, I want to be the owner. You know, I want people to pay me money. So I think real estate's been in my blood for that long, right? I got in the real estate business and my first 9 months in the business, I sold 78 houses, all for sale by owners. I've always believed that success leaves clues. So I went to a successful real estate agent. And I asked him what he did. And Sam, he made me a cassette tape. And I'm dating myself, I know that. But I equate that to podcasts of today, you know. And I listened to that tape over and over and over again. I embedded those techniques in my system. They became part of my DNA. And I went out and I just did what he did. And so it's the basic, simple fundamentals and mastering the repetitious boredom that help us do what we do, right? So I went out, I sold 78 homes my first 9 months. After that, I built a team selling 125 homes a year. I did it consecutively for about 7 or 8 years. 2005 rolled around and I saw the market starting to shift. And I knew that something was going to happen. I didn't know what it was, but I knew I needed to go do something different. So I decided to go into the apartment business. Had always wanted to be in the apartment business. Understood the private equity model, understood that piece from raise private equity, marry it with a great real estate deal. And as long as everything goes well, everybody does well, right?
Sure.
So I went and I raised $18 million. I bought 4,000 apartments. It was about $60 million worth of real estate in 30 months.
Wow.
Built a property management company managing 7,500 units. And today I'm in the coaching and training space. I've taken all my knowledge, experience, my stumbles along the way, and I put it on a platform to help other people.
Yeah, Mike, that's one. I mean, in 18 months, that's a lot of real estate to buy.
Yeah.
Those are the days you still have your hair and I have none of mine. So I'm just going to say that I can't believe you came through it with your hair still intact, first of all. But before we get into the weeds of, you know, how you did that, I'd actually love really to find out, you know, what happened between then and now. Like, why are you now in the coaching space and no longer in the active real estate investor space with 7,500 or 4,000, I guess, units that you owned?
Yeah. So great question. And it's a heck of a story. You know, I stubbed my toe along the way. And I like what you said, you know, boy, that was a heck of a lot of real estate to buy in a short period of time. Well, over leveraged, I bought too much. I grew too fast. I was very unstable. Sam, it was like balancing a chair on two legs trying to eat breakfast with your feet off the ground. I mean, it was very unstable. 2008 came around. The world hit a brick wall like a freight train at 200 miles an hour. And I thought we could sustain the damage, the impact. And I remember sitting at lunch in 2008 with my CFO and the news happened to be on people carrying boxes by the dozens out of Lehman Brothers. And I'm saying, man, we're in big trouble, aren't we? My CFO said, yeah, we're in big trouble. So I thought we could weather the storm. I didn't think the commercial side would get hit and the commercial side would sustain that bad paper and all of the things that happened in 2008. And it didn't. And so in 2010, I imploded. I had a large occupancy problem. My occupancy dropped out. I had 38 different companies and I had some that were operating really well and some that weren't. And I was over leveraged, Sam. So, you know, you can only imagine I bought $60 million worth of real estate. I only raised $18 million. Simple math says it's about 15% I put down on those deals. So I was 85% loan to value, which caused a lot of problem. So what wound up happening was I started to move money back and forth between companies. So I would take money from profitable companies and I'd put it in non-profitable companies. And that wasn't a problem. My attorney, my accountant said, you can do that. Just leave notes. Now, I was of the opinion that the market would come back pretty quick, that I've seen recessions in the past. They've lasted, you know, 17 months. And there's only been like a 10% correction. Well, this lasted, you know, 7 or 8 years and was a 40% correction in the market. And I'm trying to weather the storm. So I'm moving money back and forth between companies. And like I said, that wasn't the problem. The problem was I didn't tell my investors. And as a result of not telling my investors, I ultimately got charged with wire fraud and mail fraud charges, sentenced to 10 years in federal prison as a result of that. So I lost everything. So, you know, you can only imagine, Sam, I built this company, had moderate amount of success. You know, my lifestyle never changed. I didn't go buy big boats or fly private. I wasn't running around with crazy people or taking exotic vacation. I was trying to build a business and dumping all the money back into the company. And we got hit by the storm. And so I wound up going to prison thinking my life was over. And when I got there, wondering what had happened and how I was going to mitigate each day that went by. Well, then I was probably gone about 17 days and my wife decided she was going to leave me. And that just wiped me out. At that point, it was like, man, now what? How much worse can it get? Well, it really couldn't get any worse, right? And even as bad as things could get today, it can never get that worse again. So there's a saying in prison that says you have a choice. You can either do the time or let the time do you. And I chose to do the time. So while I was gone, I went to college. I got a 4-year bachelor's degree in theology. I wrote 2 books. I wrote one book called Exit Plan, Your Complete Guide to Multifamily Investing and Why You Need an Exit Plan Before You Buy. Matter of fact, I'd love to give a copy to your listeners at the end of the show here. I wrote ethics course. So I taught real estate, I taught property management, I taught ethics, I taught Bible studies for 5 years. I was on an outreach program, or as part of an outreach team, and we went into the community about 40 times over 4 years and told our story to small business owners, the major corporations in the area, college students. And while I was at the University of Minnesota, I had gone to this class like 4 or 5 times over the years and met a professor who we decided to do a joint venture together. And we co-authored a paper that we just had published in the Business Journal of Ethics back in January. It's an ethics case study. And it gets taught at the collegiate level for forensic accounting classes. And so I really kind of turned things around. I could have let it beat me. But what happened was somebody walked up to me I was probably there 6 weeks in prison, wondering what I was going to do. I'd gone from, you know, a moderate amount of success to all of a sudden now living in a 12-by-12 room with 3 other men that I had no idea who they were, in a 2-by-5 locker with 3 green outfits and 5 pairs of underpants, wondering what's up with my life, right? So this kid walked up to me in the gym one day and he said, hey, don't let these people beat you. He said, all they want to do is take everything from you. And they can take your apartments, they can take your cars, they can take your houses and destroy your family, but they can't take your brains and they can't take your initiative. And that was probably the best conversation anybody's ever had with me, because from that point on, I just moved forward. And it brings me to today and being here with you and you know, I have this coaching and training platform because I want to give back. I want people to know the mistakes I made and what mistakes not to make. I mean, we're in an environment today, Sam, that, you know, looks a lot like 2007, 2006. So I think there's a little tale to be told for a cautionary step back right now.
Wow. One, thank you for taking the time to be so transparent and share that. I mean, that's, you know, that's just not something that, you know, many people come on and say is, hey, by the way, I lost everything and went to prison. And how you've turned that around is remarkable. I think that, you know, you commented that comment that take your brains and your initiative. Those are two things they can't take away.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So you redeemed the time while you were in prison. What year did you get out?
You know what? 2020. So just as COVID was starting, and everybody, they were locking the world down, I came home.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah. So I've been home about a year now, a little more than a year. I spent 10 months on home confinement. So I really was locked up for about 8.5 years. And, you know, since I've been home, I've built this platform, got a book published, did a 3-day virtual event last year, done a couple boot camps since. So
that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, what a wild ride. I guess in your business now, in your, what's your coaching platform again called?
My Core Intentions.
My Core Intentions. Talk to us about what My Core Intentions is.
Yeah. So I'm an educational company. I'm a coaching and training group. What we do is I teach multifamily investors, real estate investors, and the people that support those investors. So whether you're an agent, a lender, an insurance person, you know, whatever discipline you are, how to grow your business, scale your business, but live a quality lifestyle. You know, Sam, you might or might not be able to relate to this, but, you know, I grew really fast. I mean, I sold 78 houses my first 9 months in real estate. I went on to raise $18 million in 30 months. You know, there's not a lot of time for hanging out and relaxing in the midst of that. And I think in real estate that we have a tendency to live outside of everything else in our life. We are at the beck and call of clients, of investors, of sellers, of buyers. And we need to learn how to live a better quality lifestyle. And my goal is to help people, you know, time block, time manage, learn what's most important. Because I forgot what was most important.
What, when you say that, what are some things that come to mind?
So I'll tell a story. Sometimes some of this stuff is best suited with a story. Yeah. 2008, I was getting ready to close a 200 unit deal, and I'm sitting in a title company in Cincinnati, and the deal's not closing. And I finally get my partner on the phone about 10 to 5 on a Wednesday afternoon. And he starts the conversation by saying this, "I don't know how to tell you this." Now, I don't know if you have a business partner or not, but when your partner tells you in a high stress situation, "I don't know how to tell you this," you probably are starting to wonder what's going on. So he proceeds to tell me that I can't close the deal because he can't fund it. I'm waiting for 500 grand to come from my office for earnest money for the deposit, you know, the rest of our earnest money or the rest of our equity.
Right.
And he said, proceeds to tell me that he had to move money from the escrow account to the business account, which he knew from the day one that that was an unacceptable thing. We never do that.
Right.
And he did it, said, "I thought I could have the money put back." I get off the phone. I dry close the deal, which means I just signed all the paperwork. I said, "I'll have it funded by Tuesday." I go back to the office. And long story short, over the weekend, I raised that $500,000. Gave a little bit of equity away, gave his equity away. I got the deal funded on Tuesday. But meantime, on Friday night that week, I go to dinner with my wife and his wife and him. And we go to this club. And Sam, I never talked to my wife about business. I never told her anything that was going on. She knew what I did. She knew that I closed another deal or met some investors or was looking at a new deal. But I didn't talk to her about the day-to-day stuff. I didn't tell her those things. We're coming home from dinner and she says to me, "You know, I don't trust him." Now, she has no idea what happened on Wednesday. She has no idea he moved this money. She has no idea I have to give away equity and overraise on a deal. And out of clear blue nowhere, she says, "I don't trust him." And, you know, Sam, is a good husband, what do? I say, "Honey, don't worry about this. I got it under control." And I didn't have anything under control. What I should have said was, tell me why you don't trust him. Tell me more about that. And I should have catered to my wife at that point, but I didn't, because my ego was in the way, right? Today, I would have done that differently. I would have handled that whole situation differently. And the funny thing is, Sam, we don't pay attention to the red flags along the way. So about a week later, I'm out to lunch with my legal counsel, my out-of-office legal counsel. I had an attorney that worked for me on staff, but this was my lawyer, my attorney, personal business attorney that I used for years. We're out to lunch and he says, hey, why are you in business with this guy? He goes, I've seen some things go on that you need to be aware. I said, hey, Bob, don't worry about it. I got it. And I didn't have it. So I think as a CEO, as an owner operator, a woman or a man running a company, middle management, you need to really pay attention to what people are saying around you. You need to pay attention to what's going on around you. Don't ignore the red flag. And there were two red flags right there, and three in a row, really, that I should have went, whoa, time out here. And I didn't. So, you know, today I would do that differently, but I would encourage people, get outside your body, man, and see what's going on around you.
What do you think, you know, I'm sure you've had plenty of time to do some self-introspection. So what do you think it was that caused you to just ignore?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I think that, you know, we had been friends for 25 years before we went into this business together. I took him under my wing in the real estate business because he was unemployed. I thought I had a lot of faith in him. He was a great, you know what? He was great at what he did before he came to work for me. He was great at what he did. He was an operator. He was a business turnaround guy. And I thought he'd be a great COO, but he wasn't really liked, and he just didn't get done what he needed to get done. Then he got sidetracked. A couple things happened. He got sidetracked, and I think he came off the rail.
Wow. And so then as you guys progressed, you having that history of friendship and having that long time business together, you just kept saying, hey, this will get better. This will be all right. We'll make this work. And it just got worse from there.
Yeah, I felt, you know, hey, I can go close another deal. You know, when you syndicate a deal and you close a deal, you bring fees in. I thought, I'll bring more fees in. I'll close another deal. But here's what was happening was I was closing deals and they weren't getting stabilized. So I had this very unstable portfolio, right? Where 2007, I closed 17 transactions. It was 2,700 units.
Wow.
So there's no time when you're closing that volume of transactions to stabilize anything, much less get it done. So when I thought that there were teams of contractors working on properties and teams, you know, getting things done, there weren't. I had 138 people working for me. I thought people were doing their job. Some were. And listen, let me tell you this, though. I broke the law. You know, I totally didn't tell my investors. I should have went to my investors, told them what was going on, and I didn't do that. That was on me. And I take responsibility for that. But I also take responsibility for not paying attention to everything else that was going on, because that's in theirs where most of the problem falls.
Right. Did you, if you could go back, would there be a way that you, I'm sure you've run this scenario in your head, would there have been a way to right the ship?
Yeah. Wow. You're going to take me down this road, aren't you?
You don't have to if you don't want to.
No, that's okay. Listen, I told you before we started, I'm very transparent. I'll tell everything. So those couple of events happened, right? 2008. And about 6 months later, my CFO came to me and said, hey, let me buy him out. I said, no, he'll never sell me. And he goes, I don't care. He goes, let's try. He said, if not, we should go out and do our own thing. He said, this is going in the wrong direction. So this is about third quarter of 2008 that this is happening. And I said, no, man. I said, it's never going to happen. So again, here's one of those red flags, right? So then all this stuff happened. The Friday before Christmas in 2008, I recapitalize a deal. I bring an institutional buyer in to take out my private investors on a deal. I bring about $2.8 million in profit into the company. The window closes. There's not another real estate equity deal done in the multifamily space for 2 years. I got people from Amley, from Camden Yards calling me saying, hey, how'd you get this deal done? I said, I don't know. I said, I don't know. It was a God thing, right? So fast forward 2010, the world's crazy, upside down, wondering how I'm going to stabilize the ship. I'm walking into a board meeting and at a board of advisors, Sam, I had 12 men and women who were a lot smarter than me. 10 of the 12 were in other industries. They weren't even in real estate, manufacturing, shipping, food and beverage. I had a couple lawyers, an accountant. So I had people that were a lot smarter than me on this board, and they really had my best interests. I'm walking into a board meeting in the first quarter of 2010. And I'm met in the parking lot by my in-house legal counsel. Now I'm prepared to walk in and tell them everything that's going on, why we're upside down, what do I do, and try and get some help. My attorney says, hey, I don't want to talk about any of that. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, yeah, we don't have enough information. I said, how much more information do we need? I said, we're upside down. We can't pay our bills. I can't pay my investors. I got investors trying to cash out. I said, there is no cash. I said, we need to talk to these people and figure out how to handle the storm. And he said, give me 2 weeks. Let me get some more information. We'll do a conference call. We'll put everybody on the phone and we'll figure it out then. Now I knew better. I knew better. I should have said, no, you know what? I'm going to go in and talk about this. I think that that's one of the meetings that could have changed the direction of where we went. We tried to head it off, but it was months later before we did anything else. And I think that, you know, like anything else, if you catch it early, you can maybe help it. So it was a situation where, you know, I had grown this company to 60 million. The market fell out. My valuation dropped. I needed to talk to my board about it, and I didn't. And so, you know, as a result, we wound up losing everything.
That's an interesting moment. You know, when you can, I guess, that moment of clarity where you go, gosh, if maybe then I could have. You know, they call it the accident chain.
Yeah.
Where there's these small series of steps that led up to what ultimately ended up being a catastrophic failure.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had broken that chain much earlier, maybe that would have maybe, you know, changed things. That's was there a gut check when you didn't do that?
You know, I think I was beyond gut check by that point because I knew we were in a situation. I was starting to stress and didn't know what was gonna happen. We had been talking to receivers about putting all of our companies with a receiver trying to head off the investors. And, you know, hey, listen, I'm not about throwing anybody under the bus.
Sure.
I don't, you know, I take responsibility for my actions. But here's what the conversation was at the time. The conversation was, let's shut the company down, put all everything with the receiver, let the receiver handle all the noise, and 6 months from now, we'll go start again. Not a real ethical thing to do. And I, looking back, you know, I know that today. That wasn't the conversation I was having. My conversation was, hey, how do we straighten things out? How do I make things different? You know, and today I would do it differently. I would have walked into that board meeting and said, this is where we're at. How do I handle it?
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think with that would have come in, you know, that there's a lot of freedom, I think, that comes in just honesty.
Yeah.
Honesty and telling the truth. That's a hard story that you're sharing. And I do, again, want to just reiterate that I appreciate you taking the time really to share that with us and the things that, yeah, you've paid some hefty prices for the lessons that you're sharing with us today.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that. One other question.
I really hope that the message helps people understand, you know, that there's things to pay attention to, you know, don't overbuy, make sure you're stable. Don't over leverage. Don't pay too much for properties. You know, listen to people around you. Pay attention to the red flags. Look at your metrics. You know, your KPIs don't lie. The math won't lie. So pay attention. And I say that and I stress that because I think that I have a story that conveys that. Look, this could happen. Somebody said while I was gone, somebody said, actually, I was having a conversation with my ex-wife one day, and it was just, and she said in passing, she said that this guy that we knew said, man, Mike showed how easy it was to make a mistake and go to prison. And that's what happened. You know, I made some business mistakes. The funny thing is 5 years before I got indicted, I would have been fined by the SEC slap on the hand, go back, straighten your business out. Now they dismantle everything and put you in federal prison, you know, right or wrong. Who's right or wrong anymore? I don't know. I broke the law, you know, and I made a mistake and I'm regretful for it today. And no, here's what I know is I know different today. So, you know, I'm underwriting deals again. I'm looking at deals again. We're probably going to syndicate a couple things here. But you know what? I know where the dead bodies are today that I didn't know before.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. You absolutely do. I'm curious. I'm going to ask one technical question because this is not, I didn't want this to be the focus of this podcast, was technical how to, but on, you know, occupancy is really what ended up sinking the ship for you guys.
Yeah.
Because your occupancy fell to a level where you just, I mean, even if it was poorly managed, you just couldn't bring in enough money to cover your bills. I mean, that was the short of it, right?
Yeah.
So I guess, were there things that you could have done if you had grown more slowly to have stabilized those assets and really retained them along the way? Or was it just that your bad decisions and the timing of the market ended up just being a total cluster?
Yeah, you know, here's what's funny, right? Is I would buy deals that were value add that were at 70%, and we were getting them leased up. I mean, I was in the high 80s, low 90s on most of my deals. I think if you look at my deals across the board, I was just short of 90% occupancy. But what happened was most of my deals were in tertiary markets that were supported by the car industry and the transportation industry. And if you remember back in 2008, what were the two industries to get hit the hardest? Well, three, actually: finance, transportation, and the auto industry.
Right.
So here I bought a deal in a town called Anderson, Indiana, which Anderson, Indiana was, when we bought this deal, was the number one city in the country to raise a family in. 30% of the city got rolled the carpetings up, shuttered businesses because people went out of business because they supported the car industry. And so those people lived in my apartment. You know, I owned 500 units in that town and gone like that. So, you know, when people move out, I had a property manager call me from that property one morning, Sam. She's in tears. It's Monday morning. She says, I've got 32 moving trucks in the parking lot. I don't have a move out scheduled for 45 days. Go figure.
Wow. So some of it was just bad market timing. Do you see some of that? And again, I don't want to stay here for too long, but do you, you know, those aren't things you can prepare for.
Well, that's a great topic of conversation. How do you prepare for it? Because I think that you can at some level. So this goes back to your underwriting. So if I'm underwriting a deal today, you know, your typical occupancy delta is somewhere 15 to 20%, right? So you're going to have a 10% physical vacancy. You're going to have another 5 to 10% of economic vacancy, right? So that's pretty baked into most underwriting. But what happens if this happens again? What happens if your occupancy drops out 30 or 35%? What do you do about that other 10 or 15%? Here's what I say today. Overraise money. Put some money in reserves, let it sit there at a very simple interest, pay your investors that simple interest off that money and to cover the delta. So if the deals fall and the market drops out, can you cover that gap for 20 months, 36 months? I don't know. Pick a number and underwrite your deal like that. You're going to have to raise more money, or you're going to take the initial cash flow and capital that you make on the property, put it in reserves, let it sit there, weather, because at some point you got to weather the storm.
Yeah. And that's tough to do. That's tough to do in today's environment, just because there is such a glut of, I'm not going to call it opportunity. There is a ton of deals out there, but in order to make them attractive enough to investors, I'm not going to say can't, it becomes more challenging to underwrite to that strict of an underwriting. Because then suddenly your was going to be a 17 IRR deal over, you know, 6 years is now a 12 because you've raised so much more equity, or maybe it's a 9. And suddenly, you know, investors are going 9%. That's not very good.
Yeah.
So how do you overcome that? And then I want to jump into the final four because I know we've gone long today.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that I have an answer. I certainly don't have an answer off the cuff. It's something I'd want to think through and have a conversation with the people that I'm doing the deal with. to make sure everybody's on the same page and comfortable. So,
yeah, no, that's fair. That's fair. Mike, I really enjoyed this. This has been very insightful. I do appreciate that. Here, let's jump into the final four. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Walk cautiously. Today, in today's environment, I would make sure that your underwriting is very conservative, because I think that anything could happen in the next 24 months.
Right, right. Oh, that's good. That's good. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you are doing to stay on top of your game?
I'm an advocate for education. You should be taking 10% of your income, 10% of your money every year, and dumping it back into yourself in education, reading books, going to seminars, coaching. I'm a huge advocate for coaching, Sam. I've been coached, had a personal coach for 25 years. You know what? I remember the first time I wrote a check. I wrote a check for $1,000 for 1 month of coaching. And all you got back then was one 30-minute call a week with your coach. So you didn't get what you get today. Today you get a lot, right? But listen, coaching has helped me scale my business 20% a year. Best $180,000 over 25 years I've ever spent.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what, $8,000 bucks a year, basically.
12.
Yeah. Okay. There it is. There it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Okay. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Yeah. So great question. So like I said, I've been home for about a year, and before I went away, I had a foundation and I served a community. I was partners with another group out of the Chicago market, and we served the homeless community. And I raised a bunch of money, gave a bunch of money away, a bunch of time away. And today, I think there's a couple of issues in the world that I would like to make a difference in. And homelessness is one, and the other is human trafficking. I think both really big issues tugging on my heart. So when the time comes, we'll delve back into those arenas.
Right. That's great. Mike, two questions for you here at the end. One, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that? And then secondly, if they can get a copy of your book, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, great question, Sam. Thanks. So you can reach me directly. I'm very accessible. Mike@mycoreintentions.com. Email me directly. I'm very loud on social media. So Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. Instagram and LinkedIn are the two best places. My website, you can get a hold of any of my podcasts and information. And then for my book, go to my website at mycoreintentions.com/exit plan and download a free copy, a free ebook for yourself.
Mike, thank you so much for your time. Do appreciate it.
You bet, Sam. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.